everybody, welcome to Smart Mouth. This is your host, Catherine Spires, and this week we are going to talk about what may be my favorite food in the entire planet. And before we get to that, I want to thank two of our newest Patreons, so kind of you guys, Diana Ortiz Ernst and Andrew Cardamone. Thank you so much for becoming a partner with us on Patreon. And if anyone else wants to look into that, we're at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. Thanks, everybody. Now let's get into it. One of my favorite foods, ice cream. And we're talking about it with a person who makes ice cream, Roxana Julipat. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so good. How are you doing?
Good.
So Roxana is the owner, but more importantly, the baker at Friends and Family, which is like a restaurant, coffee shop, bakery, ice creamery in Hollywood, in Thai Town specifically, for those of you who are familiar with Los Angeles. I want to know all about your professional journey.
How much time do you have?
All the time in the world for you.
Well, you know, I came to cooking / baking after college, while I thought I was going to take a break from my academic pursuits.
Okay. Has it been a longer break than anticipated?
It has been a almost 20-year long break, but at the time, I thought I should go to cooking school because I've always like cooking, and it was just a good thing to not have to, you know, get to have some schooling that wasn't so formal, you know, after I graduated from college. So, you know, I thought I was going to do it for a couple of years, you know, go to cooking school, get a few jobs. And I was like, well, worst case scenario in the future, I'll write a lot about food. At the time, I had done an internship in an institute devoted to agriculture and more for my policy or political level. So I thought, you know, this is somewhat connected.
Sure, yeah.
And then, you know, like the thing about food is that it is kind of like a very demanding endeavor. So if you are into food, you're kind of just going to be into food. It doesn't share well with other disciplines. So yeah, by the time I was able to like withdraw a little bit and think of what I wanted to do, I was pretty deep into cooking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the sweet and savory divide, it seems like in a lot of ways you're known more for sweet pastries, that sort of thing. When did you decide to go in that direction?
You know, it's interesting because it happens a lot that you go to cooking school and you feel like you are going to cook. And I go through the academic program of being a culinary student, right? Mm-hmm. So you'll do a little bit of what we call garde manger, which is salads and cold stuff. And, you know, it's very French-based. So you'll do some funky things that have no relevance in modern food, but like aspics. And
oh, yeah. And, they're still teaching aspics at culinary school?
You know, I went to school in a long time ago. So, yeah, it like you would be carving vegetables. And things of that sort. But you could also, you know, I also took like hot foods classes and we would make cassoulet and duck confit. And so you feel like you're going to pursue cooking in general, right?
Yeah.
And then the last classes, in my case, in that program I attended, the last classes were baking. You start with bread and it's pretty intense. And if you've never baked bread, like it's amazing. You're like, what? Like I invested a few minutes here and there, and then like I have all this and it looks so pretty, and at the time I thought it was so pretty. Now if I were I wouldn't be so generous.
You would grade yourself harder.
I would grade myself a lot harder for sure. But and then you do a lot of what we call pastry, so because there's definitely a divide also between bread and pastry. So you know, when I graduated cooking school, I felt like it was good. I had like a somewhat of a balanced education, and I could do whatever, right? And, you know, when you start looking for your internships or jobs or stages, you take whatever they throw at you. And typically you work a salad station or what we call pantry. And
that's like the starting rung.
That's like sort of like very basic.
Yeah.
Sometimes they let you work it by yourself. Most times you're assisting somebody.
Okay.
And sometimes you may just be in a corner peeling vegetables or
that stereotype or, is really true, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you know, like I've had people in my kitchen that have MBAs or are like, you know, this might be a second career, and same thing. You're mm-hmm. going to start doing those things that are very, very basic.
Yeah.
Before we even give you an opportunity to burn something, you know?
Right.
You have to earn the right to burn something. So I started at a very, very small place, very close to my house. I could walk, which mm-hmm. is very unusual in LA that you can walk two blocks.
For sure. Yeah.
And go to the restaurant where you work at. And I started as a pantry cook. Mm-hmm. And part of the pantry, dishes was to do dessert. And I just felt really comfortable. It seemed like very, very easy.
Okay.
Easy to make. And also, like, I felt like so challenged by the environment of really, really working in a restaurant.
Uh-huh.
That dessert seemed like, okay, this is where you get to not mess up and like do a good job. So, you know, it was interesting to see how like I naturally gravitated towards pastry. And from that point on, I felt like every job I would get was a pastry job.
Mm-hmm.
So after like 3 restaurants, I'm like, okay, maybe I should just go find someone who does this very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up at Campanile at the time, Ooh. Which is this institution restaurant that was here, was open for like 20, 25 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was founded by Nessa Silverton, who's now like the woman behind Mozza and author of many cookbooks.
Yeah.
And a culinary icon all on her own. So, yeah, I trained under Nancy and, wow. And her pastry chef at the time, who's also a really amazing baker and woman in general. So
that's a really good pedigree in the restaurant world to have worked for Nancy. You don't even have to say her last name. Not only that,
like if you get like your ass kicked like at Campanile, uh-huh. like you're probably going to be okay.
You're all set.
Yeah. 2 years of that, you're probably going to be okay.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And so tell me about ice cream. Was ice cream part of the pastry education program in culinary school?
Yes, yes. And for sure is basic, you know, because how technical can we get in ice cream?
Go for it.
Right. So, for example, all ice cream bases come from like a mother sauce, right?
Okay.
And this mother sauce of pastry is called crème anglaise or English cream, whatever is the literal translation.
Right.
And so it's basically a very light custard, like a sauce, right? Mm-hmm.
And when you say custard, that means it has eggs in it,
anytime right? you do say custard, you have dairy and you have eggs.
Right. Okay.
And like typically there's a heat involved mm-hmm. and that kind of like partially cooks the eggs
mm-hmm.
and promotes sort of like a thickening. It has a thickening effect, which is why ice cream is creamy, right? It has this sort of like density to it that comes from having dairy hit eggs that coagulate when exposed to heat. So the trick and like the expertise and like the many years of practice come when like you heat up your cream and milk to a point where it doesn't curdle the eggs, but it definitely thickens.
Okay.
Yeah. And like you're sort of like envisioning this silky, yet thick and luscious cream or crème anglaise, right?
I mean, it sounds amazing.
So,
yes.
So of course you cover that in pastry school or culinary school quite a bit, and then that becomes a sauce that you can legitimately use in desserts. Like mm-hmm. it would be like that sauce that like in classic chocolate souffle, like you pop it open and you throw a little crème anglaise.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely is a use for it. And you can also flavor that crème anglaise and spin it into ice cream. And spinning is the action of putting it through an ice cream machine that has a compressor
uh-huh.
and a spinner,
yeah.
right? And that movement while rotating in a cold environment produces the ice cream.
Yeah. Okay. So you can also technically make ice cream that does not have eggs in it.
Sure.
You're looking at me like, but you wouldn't.
But I never would. I haven't. I think that, so you know, definitions are a little ambiguous at times. Mm-hmm. But I feel like if you were to make an ice cream that doesn't have eggs, that would make it a sherbet.
Okay.
So, you know, very common with flavors that are like somewhat strong and forward, like a tangerine juice, right? Uh-huh. Which is a little bit tart, but very with a lot of personality. You add a little bit of dairy to it and you spin it, and it creates a really delicious sherbet, as opposed to a sorbet. If you were to spin the sweetened juice of tangerines, because mm-hmm. if you don't sweeten it, you're creating ice, basically, right?
Yeah.
Sugar does contribute to the texture. So if you were to spin the sweetened juice of tangerines, you would have sorbet. If you were to add dairy to it to add a little bit more creaminess and density, you would make sherbet. If you were to combine that same juice with crème anglaise, you're making tangerine ice cream.
I love it. I love your definitions of it. There used to be a thing where people would call the ice cream that had eggs, whole eggs in it, French style. And then if it only had egg whites or no eggs, they called it Philadelphia style. I haven't seen those terms used in a very long time.
In a very long time. I think, to tell you the truth, I think these are marketing terms.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. It's like what Breyers would label it with.
I used to work with a guy from Oklahoma, and he was obsessed with calling ice cream frozen custard.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
And I was like, I see your point, and it's exactly that's exactly what it is. Uh-huh. However, it's confusing.
Yeah.
And nobody gets it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. I agree with that. But Midwesterners will do that. They have their frozen custard thing going on.
Right.
And they do.
Or like people would say premium, and that means that it has more eggs, I suppose, or high fat, which means it has more cream.
All those terms.
And I think those are just like industry terms to jacked up the price.
No, absolutely. There's things that people don't know about ice cream. Some of them are fine. Like, for instance, in America, we have the Food and Drug Administration, and they actually define ice cream by its fat level. So it has to have at least 10% fat in it.
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy to do.
So apparently most ice cream has 14 to 25% fat.
Yeah, it's definitely not light.
No, certainly not. Why would you want it to be? That's why things like low-fat ice cream, that's a real bummer. I think. Like, if you're going to eat ice cream,
right.
Enjoy
it. It's a real
it.
Bummer. It's true. I think, you know, it's like this, and yet, you know, like we have such health issues related to a high fat diet mm-hmm. that like you can certainly empathize and understand why this phenomenon came about.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure it has been effective. Like, you know, there's a lot of conversation about whether or not a lower fat diet has made anybody thinner
right.
or healthier, right?
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. But and what I find true as a technical person who deals with food and creates these effects, mm-hmm. I would say that anytime you remove fat, you'll end up using other things to compensate
yes,
for it.
Yes, yes.
Whether it's more sugar or even a little bit more starch.
Mm-hmm.
So you are denaturing your ice cream. And maybe adding things, you know, it's like a perfect example is vegan food.
Yeah.
You know, anytime you're substituting those eggs and that butter mm-hmm. and that cream, you will find yourself using things like tapioca, cornstarch, xanthan gum and war gum. And, you know, you really have to weigh in, like, am I making better food?
Yeah.
In the name of veganism.
Yeah. I know. I totally agree with you. Yeah.
You know, sometimes you do. Sometimes you can get away with not using this strange and somewhat not very mm-hmm. natural ingredients mm-hmm. and make something delicious. But eggs are pretty miraculous, so it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really good in a lot of things. Yeah. I imagine vegans who eat like a lot of salads with nuts and stuff like that could be really healthy. But
right.
packaged vegan food, packaged any food, that's when they start putting
right.
in the additives
right.
and things get mm-hmm. a little wacky.
A little wacky. Sure. And it's also like, do you really need to eat all that coconut fat?
Right.
Probably not.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So there's also the thing called overrun that happens in store-bought. Well, it's part of ice cream. It's when the air is churned into it.
Right.
So American ice cream, according to the FDA's rules, can be up to 50% air. And that's why so many of the ice creams that call themselves low fat or fewer calories or whatever, and you pick them up, everybody should go to the grocery store and do this. Pick up a pint of low fat and hold it against, in your other hand, a pint of Häagen-Dazs. They weigh two different amounts.
Right.
Because the one has overrun, and that's why it's low fat, because there's less of it.
Well, and then, you know, people, a very common question that, from customers I get is like, what's the difference between gelato and ice cream?
Yes.
And I guess gelato is less air. So a more dense
ice cream. Exactly. Right. And, but it also has less fat just because of the ingredients.
It does have less fat. Yeah.
So I can see why it would be a more satisfying treat because there's less overrun, and but it's...
However, you would be amazing how great that air is in ice cream. You know, there's a few ice creams that especially catch air in a very special way.
Really?
Yeah, and they're usually ice creams that are higher in fat. A perfect example would be olive oil ice cream, right? Which had was kind of like trendy for a few years.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not as trendy anymore. I feel like people do more like really good olive oil on top of vanilla ice cream now. But I make an ice cream that I really, really like, and it's like just lemon curd that we fold, like we stir into a plain vanilla base. And that, because lemon curd is made with butter and way more eggs, it definitely has this like ability to catch air, and it really, 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 really benefits the texture. It gives it like a little bite. It's delicious.
That is, I'm having like a psychosomatic reaction because when I eat lemony stuff, I sweat a little bit, and it's happening just hearing about it. I shouldn't say that on air. That's embarrassing. Whatever. So the history of ice cream, so many people just say Catherine de' Medici invented it, and they leave it at that. Obviously, that's not the case if you think about it for even 2 seconds. I hate it when wealthy people in history get credit for inventing things because they weren't in the kitchen.
Well, you know, she gets a lot of credit for a lot of things in the culinary world.
Yes.
So maybe she was responsible for bringing awareness and showcasing it and kind of like showing it off to the right people.
Right.
That it would take it to Austria and then France and then the rest of Europe and, you know, eventually America.
Yeah, like, she can get all the credit for being the person that people paid attention to and decided they wanted to eat like her, but she didn't invent it. She's important in culinary history because, little known fact, France didn't have good food necessarily until she was sent over there from Italy, her native country, for an arranged marriage.
That sounds like a very skewed version of history.
Well, Yeah, she
but doesn't it sound more logical that, you know, there was snow and there was ice and I'm sure like somebody put something delicious on ice or snow. I mean, a snow cone must have happened way before.
Absolutely. I was nodding so much I forgot to talk. Yes. You are absolutely correct. It's even mentioned in the Bible.
Oh, there you go.
Yes. In the stories about King Solomon, they would specifically talk about him drinking iced drinks. I mean, however you would want to translate it from Aramaic.
Cocktails.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, exactly. He was sipping cocktails. Iced drinks, cold drinks, slushy drinks during hot months. And the thing is that to a certain extent fruit, but mostly ice. That is the rich people ingredient.
Right.
Because until we had refrigeration, getting ice meant sending your servants up a mountain. I mean, servants is like the best word for it.
Right.
Up a mountain, cutting ice out of the mountain, carrying it back down on their back.
Right.
It was not just for anyone. So jumping ahead another 700 years after King Solomon, around 200 BCE in China, they added milk to it.
Smart people.
Yes, exactly. They're always doing good stuff with food over there in China. So they get the credit for that, although maybe around the same time over west in the Persian Empire, they also added a little milk. They added fruit well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is...
I bet. Yeah, I can see apricots and almonds and...
Yeah, all that good stuff. They were just juicing everything into it. Also, you mentioned sherbet earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There's an Arabic drink that goes back to as long as people can remember. Actually, no, that's a lie. It goes back, from my reading, at least to the medieval era.
Okay.
It's called sherbet.
Okay.
Clearly, it's the same thing.
Right.
Chilled drink that were usually flavored quince, pomegranate, or cherry.
Oh, yum.
Yeah. Sounds so good. We mostly do orange here, but that's, I think, because it's easier to get than the other fruits, which are Middle Eastern fruits.
Right.
Yeah. Sorbetto was first written about in Italy, which means that they had been eating it for well before, but first written about in Italy in the 1600s. So it's basically moving out,
right,
outward, all these glorious frozen treats. And you start to see more of it as time goes on and people figure out refrigeration and freezers and ice and all of that kind of stuff. In fact, so the Oxford English Dictionary says that the first time the phrase iced cream, with a D, iced cream, mm-hmm. was in 1688. Mm. And then ice cream came later in 1744, which it is noted that more or less corresponds to when the difference between old-timey ice cream and quote-unquote modern ice cream, when they started using instruments that we would recognize.
Wasn't there a story about a world fair where, like, ice cream was presented?
Probably. The world fairs moved food around a lot. I don't know that particular story.
I think that
though.
That was like the breakthrough in America or something.
That could well be. It's wild to me to think that world fairs, at least the American ones, they used to actually introduce foods to people, new foods.
Right.
That's great. Oh, you know what? I feel like I'm starting to remember the story you're talking about, because it was the same year that there was a German booth with waffles. And there's some story.
That was a good year.
Yeah, I know. Seriously. Some apocryphal story about the ice cream guy running out of cones and the German guy being like, you know, if you roll these up and let them cool, it's the same thing.
If it's not true, we should make it official.
I know. We could just pretend, because it is a pretty glorious, glorious story. So there was a cookbook that was published in England in 1718, and it was called Mrs. Mary Eel's Receipts. Receipt, of course, being the original word for recipe. It had a couple printings in that era, and they always said that she was the confectioner to Queen Anne, Queen of England at that point. My understanding is that that might not necessarily
be Queen Anne,
true.
The one who died?
They all
lost
died.
Her head? Married to Henry VIII?
No. Oh, well, okay, after okay, him. She okay, was, okay. She did not get beheaded this
one. Oh, good for her.
Yeah, right? Smart woman. where was I? Oh, she may or may not have been Queen Anne's cook, because back then you could just say whatever you wanted.
Right.
No problem.
Right.
But it was the first English cookbook to have a recipe for ice cream.
Nice.
And what's weird about the recipe is how similar and how different it is from how you would make ice cream now. So you take tin pots, and then you have to surround each pot by what they say 18 to 20 pounds of ice. But smash that ice up so that it gets all around it. And then you have to get a pail, and you put a layer of straw at the bottom, and then the ice, and then you put the pot that has the cream on it, and then more straw and more ice, and you set that for at least 4 hours. Quote, in a cellar where no sun or light comes. It will be froze in 4 hours, but it may stand longer. Then take it out just as you use it. And then she also says that if you would like to freeze any sort of fruit, like raspberries, currants, or strawberries, throw those in too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing that I see with her recipe is that it's not spun.
Yes. Yes. Yes, exactly. And that probably because...
So she got a block of cream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
However, somebody had gone down in the cellar and stirred that with a whisk or something similar every so often, that cream would have had a little bit of air incorporated to it.
Yeah.
And a little bit of a smoother texture.
It does sound more like just frozen cream with things in it if you put things in it.
Sure, delicious.
Because stirring before the freezing, it doesn't do anything special, right?
No. You would really need to. I mean, like the I guess like if I've always imagined like if you're the if the when the ice cream is in the cold environment, in the batch freezer, that's what they call the ice cream machines, right? If you were to go buy a commercial ice cream machine, you wouldn't buy an ice cream machine. You would buy a batch freezer, which I find really not intuitive at all. But basically, the way I explain it to myself is you have this cream, and there's a slow process of mini bits of ice cream of cream turning into ice while they're being beat up by a beater or like a paddle or whatever we want to call the instrument in the middle. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you, it would never become a nice chunk. However, there's mini tiny particles of ice.
Okay.
And the mass of all of those combined makes ice cream. And the reason why it's not icy would be because we're adding sugar, which makes it nice and smooth. Mm-hmm. And also we have the fat, which also makes it nice and smooth. And the fact that like the particle is so small, right? Like that beater is really breaking it up and progressively breaking it up even more, mm-hmm. that it never becomes a palpable chunk of ice, but rather tiny, tiny little bits of ice.
This is the only kind of science I'll ever be interested in. I love it. Yeah, that's really interesting.
But you really have to think about it to really like say, like, is that what happened?
Yeah, yeah. Reverse engineering.
Right.
That's very cool. So you'll notice that so far, the sweetness that's added has always been fruit in the old world. It took Americans to start adding things like chocolate and nuts. Just when you put more fat in it, that's an American thing for sure. But good for us,
right.
I think.
Right.
And a lot of people believe that it was Amish ice cream makers.
Of course.
And that apparently, I believe, is part of the reason why American ice cream was sometimes marketed as Philadelphia style. Of course, that area has a relatively high number of Amish people. And then there's also this talk about, like, you know, the Philadelphia style thing. People are like, huh, I wonder why. Maybe it's the Amish thing, or maybe it's just lost to time.
Maybe it sounds like more handmade.
Right. For sure.
Crank.
Yeah. I like that for sure. So one thing that I have started to notice the more I do this show is that lots of times, especially with American food, or maybe only with American food, when people are like, we have no idea, it means that Black people did it. Because they often don't get their stories told.
Right.
And they were often the ones who were actually doing the cooking. So there was a man named Augustus Jackson. And he was born in Philadelphia. And then he went to work for the White House. He worked there under Monroe and John Quincy Adams. He was a dessert chef there. And apparently he really perfected ice cream while he was working in the White House. And then he retired from the White House, moved back to Philadelphia, and franchised ice cream parlors.
Good,
so it was like
him.
The first ice cream parlors were in Black communities in Philadelphia. And he also figured out a way to keep it long enough to be wholesale. Mm-hmm. So he was also selling, I guess it was quarts back then, to other people who could sell it. And he sold it for $1 a quart, which was pretty expensive then.
Right.
Ice cream, good ice cream, has always been not inexpensive.
Right.
Treat. But obviously it's so delicious that once you have it, you're like, fine, I'll pay that much for it.
Yeah, and it was, you know, now we sit with a couple of pints and watch a game or or Game of Thrones or or the Olympics.
Yes. Yeah, watching all those athletes and being like, but this ice cream's good.
And like, it's like you can binge and like, it's fun and you just spend $5 at the most. But, you know, like, it really is a treat, you know?
It really is
like pretty intense what went into making even like Cherry Garcia, you know?
Yeah.
My personal favorite.
Cherry Garcia is a delicious concoction.
It is pretty good.
It's such a good idea.
You know, Ben & Jerry's does a really, and I you know, I don't want to promote another business.
Or a
large corporation over,
you
know,
don't
small independent businesses. Mm-hmm. But I really feel like they do good stuff.
Yeah. And it's also worth seeking out, to your point, the regional ice cream makers. I love McConnell's. I don't know if that's available outside of Southern California.
I don't know either.
Yeah. But if anyone does
find it
outside of SoCal, let us know so we can tell everyone. Because boy, do they do good work.
Yes.
My goodness.
And you can tell it's a small operation because even though they have several shops, like they're just the lineup of their flavors, it's not 50, you know, it's a few, like maybe a couple dozen at the most.
Yeah.
And there's you can tell that there's a very handmade quality to it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh man, it's so good. I was reading something today about how many calories cross-country skiers have to eat. You know, the ones
good
who like go to the Olympics.
This makes me mad.
It's 4,000 for the women, up to 8,000 for the men per day.
Wow.
So they have the opposite food issue that most Americans do, and that they literally become exhausted from eating.
Right, right.
That's so crazy. And they eat because they want to get in as many calories as possible. They'll eat things like donuts and ice cream and drink regular Coca-Cola because they just need the calories.
It is for sure. I trained for the LA Marathon a couple years ago, and I couldn't believe how much I was supposed to eat.
Yeah.
And you don't burn it. You really don't. It's like it's just you're just building that storage, you know?
Well, that's right, isn't it? Because that way you don't wake up in the middle of the night starving. You need to already have it.
It was incredible.
It's the stuff you don't...
I mean, I was seriously like, I'm like, I've never eaten so much in my life.
Right. Was like, were your jaws tired?
And it's not... It wasn't never... It was, you know, because I... it's more like you really have to eat things that you know that are good for runners. So for example, you would eat like brown rice, but you wouldn't eat a lot of broccoli because that it makes you gassy and like bloated on a run, so you don't want to do that. So which it was very opposite to how I eat, and you have to eat protein, but it's just like a big chunk of chicken breast,
right?
And then a lot of those bars and but don't do granola, not too much, because it has a lot of fiber and you don't want to have like GI problems on the course. It's a very interesting diet, the runner diet.
To eat like an athlete requires so much thought. You really have to focus
really
on
crazy.
It.
It's really crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It is crazy. One guy was saying that his children find him boring because he has to eat all the time, so they'll go do things. And he's like, I can't be away from food for more than 2 hours, so y'all go on. And I'm going to be sitting here eating my ice cream by myself.
Right.
But I guess it's worth it if you get to go to the Olympics.
Ice cream wasn't on my list of things that I could eat. However, yogurt, yes. And it had to be like full fat yogurt.
Right.
And with fruit in it, with sugar in it, basically. Yeah, you eat I didn't find this diet particularly healthy, actually.
You added the sugar to the yogurt?
Well, or it would be like, don't buy any of those that don't have sugar. You had to like eat whatever, like strawberry yogurt.
Oh, so you had to buy like nasty like Yoplait stuff?
Well, I think I had like Chobani, but like the one with everything.
Right.
You know?
Extra sugar edition.
Yes.
So weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess... That's why running sucks, because you don't get to eat the ice cream. Everyone should be a cross-country skier.
Well,
instead.
Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely not ice cream. No, not a lot of dairy in running.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, with Pennsylvanians contributing to the history of ice cream, a guy from Pittsburgh, which everybody on the East Coast, I'm aware it's not Philadelphia, but they're close enough. A guy from Pittsburgh named Alfred Krall. He was also an African-American man, and he patented the ice cream scoop
Good
in 1897.
For him. Yeah. No way.
Yeah. He just by watching, he worked in restaurants, and just by watching how hard it was to get ice cream out with regular spoons or ladles or whatever, he's like, I should figure this out. The sad side of this is that even though he patented, apparently everyone else made their own too. We know it's so ubiquitous now. So we didn't become a millionaire off of it. But speaking of love of ice cream, in 1899, 5 million gallons of ice cream were produced in the U.S.
Wow.
In 1909, just 10 years later, it was 30 million.
And nowadays?
I don't even know nowadays. By 1919, it was 150 million gallons. Just in the U.S. And then that segues right into Prohibition. So during Prohibition, drugstores, that's when they started setting up the soda fountains.
Right.
And there's a couple reasons why that might have been. One, I think, is that people were just switching their vice from alcohol to sugar, which is actually kind of a common thing that still happens. You gotta have your treats.
Right.
In any form. The other thing is that... people who could drink often had prescriptions for it. Like that was a way that you could continue to drink during Prohibition, is if your doctor prescribed you like your daily shot of vodka or have you.
Okay.
But you had to go to the pharmacist to drink it. So if there's a counter where you can sit down and enjoy it, you might end up getting
and
a
then
banana
you can
split.
Bring your family and they have ice cream. You get your shot of vodka.
Yes.
Then,
See, it's such a family friendly activity. I think it's a little bit of a shame that soda fountains aren't as ubiquitous as they once were.
Yeah.
There's one in South Pasadena.
Right.
That's really
fun.
Soda
Jerks, right?
No. Not that. I wasn't thinking of that place, but I'm Fair Oaks Pharmacy.
Fair Oaks Pharmacy, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would change things if I owned it, but they do have the basic setup and they make the teenage boys wear the paper hats and stuff like that, which is super fun.
But it's also, I think it's really great also that ice cream changed, you know, like some of, you know, I don't know that it's the most delicious, but I find it really interesting, like how, you know, for a time here in Los Angeles, it was really difficult for restaurants to get permitted to have ice cream machines or batch freezers because they were almost always imported. And they wouldn't be NSF approved. And NSF means that they are cleanable. And is what does NSF stand for? National Safety Federation.
Federation, that makes more sense.
So it's basically a seal that is awarded to kitchen equipment to say that it's safe to use, that is sanitary because it has the mechanisms to be cleaned up regularly.
Okay.
So things like meat slicers will have an NSF. I mean, every single piece of equipment I have in my kitchen is NSF. But these machines would not be NSF approved. So people either like flew under the radar or they would have a health inspector come and say, this is not cool. Or for this to be NSF, you have to do X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when Campanile got their inspection and they realized that the batch freezer wasn't NSF approved, they made them create a cold room for it so that the cold environment will sort of protect this high-risk food that is ice cream.
Uh-huh.
And I'm saying that sarcastically.
You have an ice cream counter. In your restaurant.
I do, yeah.
And do you make all the ice cream here?
We do.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Do you have a flavor that you make that is your favorite?
Yes. It's mint chip.
Mint chip.
Yeah.
The
for
classic.
Sure.
Do you diet green?
No. we actually use mint, and is funny enough, the varietal that we use is called chocolate mint. And it does have like a teeny bit of chocolatey ness to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gives you like just enough. It's actually, you know what? It's actually quite punchy. And then I use a natural, just to balance it out, I put a few drops of a natural mint extract. But you have to be careful because you could end up with toothpaste. So.
Right.
And then we do make our own chips because I like them really nice and thin so that they melt in your mouth.
Ah.
Yeah, that one's definitely delicious. I'm pretty basic with ice cream. Like I'll go for cookies and cream,
the classics.
Yeah, strawberry, chocolate, vanilla. I like my vanilla. I like to make it with brown sugar instead of regular sugar,
yes.
Just because in general I like to go dark on flavors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they all look delicious out there.
Thank you.
Roxana, thank you so much for letting us take over the kitchen
back here
and interview you. Where should people follow you on social media?
I am on Instagram at Roxana Julapat with one N. That would be Roxana with one N. And Julapat is J-U-L-L-A-P-A-T. Or you can follow our shop, Friends and Family. And our handle is at We Are Friends and Family.
Awesome. And they post lots of beautiful bakery item pictures on that. Everybody, thank you so much. And Roxana, thank you too.
Sure, thank you.
Dedicate one to the lady. Sometimes a babe needs something to keep you cool. Sometimes a babe needs something to keep you cool. Better look out now, though. Dave's got something for you. Tell you what it is. I'm your ice cream man, stop me when I'm passing by. Oh my, I'm your ice cream man, stop me when